On the show today, tensions between the U.S. and China are on the rise.
Encounters between Chinese and other nations' vessels, such as the Philippines, have increased in recent years, along with Beijing's military activity in the region. The U.S. is also adopting a more muscular approach, ramping up drills with allies in the region.
Plus, members of the U.S. House of Representatives react to the destruction of the dam in southern Ukraine.
I think we assume that Russia does all these things. I mean, that's always my presumption. They're habitual liars.
And we meet the man responsible for many of Disney's most loved amusement park rides, who kept something secret from the company for decades. Today is Thursday, June 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. South Korea scrambled fighter jets after Chinese and Russian military aircraft entered its air defense zone in the south and east of the Korean Peninsula. The incursion followed encounters between U.S. and Chinese forces in the Taiwan Strait and South China Sea, which the Biden administration cites as examples of growing aggressiveness by Beijing's military. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara takes a look at the rising tension between global powers playing out in the Indo-Pacific.
At least two incidents of close encounters between Chinese and American vessels and aircraft in less than 2 weeks, including this Chinese warship cutting closely in front of a U.S. destroyer in the Taiwan Straits on Sunday. The incident coincides with trilateral naval exercises in the South China Sea among the U.S., Japanese, and Philippine Coast Guards. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin.
The U.S. made provocations first, and the Chinese side only responded by handling the incident in accordance with relevant laws and regulations.
Since you have disregarded our warning, we will take further necessary measures on you.
Encounters between Chinese and other nations' vessels, such as the Philippines, have increased in recent years, along with Beijing's military activity in the region. The U.S. is also adopting a more muscular approach, ramping up drills with allies in the region. Beijing considers these provocations, leading to even more incidents that could easily escalate into conflict, said Zuri Linetsky, a research fellow at the Eurasia Group Foundation via Zoom.
It's part of a new and disturbing norm, particularly given the fact that there's limited communication between high-level defense officials in the United States and China.
The White House denies it's partly to blame and says it's trying to talk to Beijing.
We're working on this very, very hard, and the president's confident that we'll be able to get back to the spirit of Bali between the PRC and the United States.
At the annual Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore last week, Beijing declined Washington's request for a face-to-face meeting between Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and his Chinese counterpart Li Shangfu, due to sanctions on Li that have not been lifted by the administration. Officials are working to reschedule U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to Beijing that Washington canceled after it shot down a Chinese spy balloon in January. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. lawmakers are considering legislation that would tighten sanctions on Syria and impede normalizing relations with any Syrian government led by President Bashar al-Assad. However, some analysts say the bill will hurt the Syrian people and not the Assad regime. For VOA, Dale Gavlek reports from Amman, Jordan.
The bill introduced by U.S. Representative Joe Wilson and some 35 colleagues expands on the Caesar Act, which imposed a tough round of sanctions on Syria in 2020. The new measure, known as the Assad Regime Anti-Normalization Act of 2023, would penalize Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and others which have reestablished diplomatic ties with the Assad government if they invest in Syria. Wilson chairs the subcommittee on the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia. The United States had pressed Arab states and allies to seek concessions from Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad before they readmitted Syria to the Arab League, but that's believed not to have happened. Assad has remained unrepentant for atrocities against his people during the country's more than 12-year-old civil war. Washington has said it will not normalize relations with Assad's government or support U.S. allies doing so. Observers say that the conflict has killed nearly 500,000 Syrians and displaced half of the country's pre-war population of 23 million. Syria analyst Joshua Landis of the University of Oklahoma believes sanctions on the Assad regime will not bring justice to the Syrian people, but further impoverish them. He spoke during a Washington-based Quincy Institute webinar.
How does the Caesar sanctions make Assad repent or bring justice to Assad? It seems to me that the injustice that they bring to the 16, 17 million people under the government control is infinitely larger than the inconvenience that it causes Assad and his cronies who still live in palaces while everybody else is starving.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Bahrain, William Roebuck, who is the executive vice president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, explained the rationale behind the new sanctions.
The driving force in those sanctions is we are not going to let Assad and his regime get away with this. It's not going to affect their quality of life or any way. It is going to prevent the regime from rebuilding. It's going to limit many things that the Assad regime would like to do to consolidate its power.
It's believed Arab states did not make any public financial commitments to rebuilding Syria during the Arab League summit, but they are pressing Damascus to stop its production and trafficking of Captagon, an amphetamine estimated to be worth $10 billion a year to the regime. If the U.S. House bill becomes law, a review for possible financial penalties would be triggered any time a country made an investment, grant, contract, or donation worth more than $50,000 to parts of Syria held by Assad's government. Assad still does not control the country's vast northeast or northwest. Del Gavlak for VOA News, Amman Jordan.
In Saudi Arabia on Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with his Saudi and Gulf Cooperation Council counterparts in Riyadh as part of his visit to the kingdom. Blinken met earlier on Wednesday with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman amid strained relations between Riyadh and Washington. This is Blinken's second trip to Saudi Arabia since becoming America's top diplomat, and it comes after the kingdom under Crown Prince Mohammed has been more willing to disregard the U.S. in its decisions. Riyadh has clashed repeatedly with President Joe Biden on its supply of crude oil to global markets, its willingness to partner with Russia in OPEC Plus, and reaching a détente with Iran that was mediated by China. Biden has also pledged to make Saudi Arabia a pariah over the 2018 killing of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. However, Saudi Arabia still relies on the U.S. to be the security guarantor for the wider Middle East as tensions over Iran's nuclear program in recent years have spilled over into a series of attacks. Blinken met with Prince Mohammed early Wednesday. The State Department said the two discussed their shared commitment to advance stability, security, and prosperity, and that the secretary also emphasized the bilateral relationship is strengthened by progress on human rights. A Saudi statement acknowledged the meeting, but offered no specifics. And we're also following these stories from around the world. Pope Francis underwent surgery to repair a hernia on Wednesday. The Vatican said there were no complications. The 86-year-old Pope is expected to remain at the hospital for several days. New Nigerian President Bola Tinubu announced he would soon end a decade-old fuel subsidy, saying the country can no longer afford it. His comments sparked panic buying of gas and raised concerns about inflation. More than a dozen U.S. states were under air quality alerts on Wednesday as smoke from hundreds of wildfires burning in eastern Canada drifted south. And Pakistanis traditionally give generously to charity, but now charities are feeling pressure as donations drop amid record-setting inflation. This as low tax collection hurts economic growth, forcing more people to rely on those charities for survival. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
There is an interplanetary competition between Saturn and Jupiter that has been going on for years. The race is based on how many moons have been discovered circling each planet. Scientists, for example, would find new moons orbiting Jupiter that would push the planet into the contest lead, and then new satellites would be found around Saturn and it would become the front runner. Back and forth it went between the solar system's two biggest planets. Back in February, astronomers discovered 12 new moons around Jupiter, allowing it to take the lead from Saturn. Recently, astronomers led by Edward Ashton of Taiwan's Academia Sinica Institute of Astronomy and Astrophysics and formerly of the University of British Columbia have discovered 60 new moons circling Saturn. So, the ringed planet is now ahead with 145 moons to Jupiter's 92-moon collection. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. The war in Ukraine is at the top of British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's agenda as he starts a two-day trip to Washington. Associated Press correspondent Charles Della Desma reports.
The US and the UK are the two biggest military donors to Ukraine, and the war will be the focus of Sunak's meeting on Thursday with President Joe Biden. Britain and the US are lead players in an international effort to give Ukraine F-16 fighter jets, and talks are also likely to include extra air defence measures against Russian bombardment in Ukraine, the breaching of a major dam in southern Ukraine, which sent floodwaters gushing through the region, has given the subject added urgency. The trip's Sunak's first to the US capital since he took office in October, but his fourth meeting with Biden in as many months. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And the war in Ukraine, specifically the dam explosion in the south, was on the minds of people at the US House of Representatives on Wednesday. It's where VOA's Katerina Lisanova caught up with Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, who is quite blunt about who he feels is responsible.
I think we assume that Russia does all these things. I mean, that's always my presumption. They're habitual liars, and it's totally consistent with everything else they've done. There's certainly no benefit to Ukraine to blowing up that dam. Be careful, sir. But we'll find the facts. You know, we don't want to speculate. We'll find out what the facts are, and but at my presumption would be, I mean, it's consistent with everything else Putin's done. He doesn't conform with any norms. He'd have no problem blowing up a dam and trying to flood out of town and hurt and kill innocent civilians. So,
Stacey Plaskett represents the Virgin Islands in Congress, and her tone was perhaps more genial, but she echoes the sentiment that the U.S. supports the Ukrainian people.
Well, I think that you're going to find, as the investigation goes on with regard to who actually, what precipitated and what was the cause of the dam being broken and the flooding that's happening, that the U.S. is going to stand firm with the Ukrainian people and with the government of Ukraine, and that we're going to provide the support that's necessary. We've, of course, given military support, but at the end of the day, it's about the people. And so we're going to be there to help the people as well.
We'll meet the designer of Disney theme park rides in a moment. First, though, with Turkey facing a looming financial crisis, newly re-elected President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has turned to a market-friendly policymaker named Mehmet Simek to lead the finance ministry. Analysts say it's a dramatic economic policy shift, but as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, questions remain as to whether Erdogan can stay the course.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's appointment of Mehmet Şimşek, a former U.S. banker, as finance minister is widely seen as heralding an end to Erdogan's unorthodox policy of cutting interest rates to tame soaring inflation, running officially at around 40%.
It marks a 180 and about turn in economic policies from Erdogan. Remember, he's run unorthodox policies for much of the last decade. Şimşek was in a previous Erdogan administration with those unorthodox policies and kind of left because he didn't like them. So I think the fact that he's come back suggests that Erdogan has recognized that he has to do something differently.
Many blame Erdogan's low interest rate policy for fueling inflation, which remains stubbornly high, especially for food, with traders and buyers hit hard.
Everyone's purchasing power is decreasing. That is very clear, especially on the days when fruits and vegetables are sold in the market. It is very visible how much people's buying capacity has decreased.
The Turkish lira has weakened to record lows in the aftermath of Erdogan's re-election, and Turkey has few foreign currency reserves left to defend it. Tourists from abroad are expected to replenish foreign currency reserves, but analysts warn time is running out to avert a crisis.
Turkey is heading very rapidly to a currency crisis, or more formally speaking, balance of payments crisis. I personally think Turkey cannot survive this winter without major, substantive, and credible economic policy change.
Returning to the economic orthodoxy of increasing interest rates to tame inflation is one option for increasing foreign investment and may even bring Turkey closer to traditional Western allies.
A return to, you know, orthodox economic policies, which will emphasize the importance of Western markets, Western lenders, financial institutions, etc. And this will probably have a bearing on the political aspect of the foreign policy.
But taming inflation with high interest rates is a painful process, reducing economic growth and hitting especially hard Turkey's large construction industry, which depends on cheap money. Moreover, with the construction industry having close ties to Erdogan, questions remain as to whether the government will continue with an orthodox economic policy.
The concern is that 6 months down the line and before local elections that are due in early next year, that Erdogan may have enough of this type of policy and may actually change, put pressure on Şimşek not to do what he needs to do or even fire him.
Erdogan has already declared his priority to retake the Istanbul mayorship from the opposition. Politics, as ever, are likely to dictate whether Turkey perseveres and makes difficult decisions on the economy. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Bob Gurr is the amusement ride designer and imagineer who designed everything on wheels for Disney, was also hiding a secret. It wasn't until the 2000s that Gurr announced his homosexuality to the world, and in so doing became something of an icon for Disney's gay community. Maxim Moskalkov spoke with the 91-year-old Disney legend.
As the US celebrates this year's LGBTQ Pride Month, Bob Gurr, Disney's famous amusement ride designer, will turn 92. He's openly gay, but didn't speak openly about it until long after he quit working for Disney.
I grew up in the era of the Senator McCarthy, head of the FBI, the fact that all homosexuals were going to be ferreted out and gotten rid of. And when I was very young, we had to keep ourselves invisible, and all of us thought we were the only one.
Gurr remembers he tried to fit himself into what was considered a societal norm, and was even married for some time. But as he says, it never worked out. In 1954, he got a job with Disney.
Occasionally, they would inquire, "Oh, Bob, we don't see you with a wife. And Bob, yeah, is that your friend? Is that your boyfriend?" You know, just little suggestions. But at no time do I recall any unkind word directed to me, either in the company or outside the company.
He spoke openly about his sexual orientation only in the 2000s, when US society became seemingly more accepting and tolerant. And in 2019, the Walt Disney Company invited him to participate in the Los Angeles Gay Pride Parade and take a ride on the omnibus he designed in the 1950s.
This is as out as you're ever going to get. going down Santa Monica Boulevard, watching several hundred thousand people cheering and waving and everything.
Almost all the amusement rides at Disneyland were designed by Gurr. The famous monorail, Autopia vehicles, the submarine Voyage, flying saucers, over 100 rides were done by Gurr. But he does have a favorite.
Oh, it's very easy. The little fire engine on Main Street. One of the drivers down there has driven it for 42 years. He loves that fire engine.
Walt Disney personally hired Gurr all those years ago, and their work side by side lasted for over a decade until Disney died in 1966.
It's very easy and very natural for everyone. Working with Walt had a conversation that was always one-on-one. He never talked down to people. And for that, those characteristics, people loved him and would do anything for him.
Today at 91, Gurr is as full of energy as ever. He hosts a Disney history tour, loves mountain biking, and organizes meetings with fans. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, Lionel Messi has a new team. The AP's Gethin Kulba explains.
Lionel Messi is taking his talents to South Beach. Messi is set to join Inter Miami CF of Major League Soccer in the United States. The club is owned by former English soccer star David Beckham. The 35-year-old Argentinian forward spent the last two seasons with Paris Saint-Germain in France after a storied 17-year career with La Liga side Barcelona. All told, Messi has scored 806 goals across 1,027 career matches, placing him second all-time behind Cristiano Ronaldo. Messi won his first World Cup title with Argentina at last year's event in Qatar. I'm Gethin Kulba.
And that'll do it for us today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
June 8th is World Ocean Day, an opportunity to recognize that the ocean influences nearly every aspect of our lives. It produces over half of the planet's oxygen, supports the greatest abundance of life on our planet, and because it facilitates transportation and recreation, it is indispensable to the world's economy. Nearly half of all species on Earth depend on the ocean for survival.
The ocean sustains all life on Earth. It provides livelihoods for millions of people. We eat fish from the ocean. It connects us. It feeds us. It drives our climate. And it's really an integral part of many cultures and many countries around the world define themselves by the sea.
But it is no exaggeration to say that today, the ocean is under serious threat from pollution, overfishing, and loss of coastal habitats, most of it caused by human activity. To protect and conserve the ocean, the United States last year introduced the Ocean Conservation Pledge. It is a very simple pledge, said Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Jose Fernandez.
We pledge to conserve 30% of the oceans under our jurisdiction in the U.S. And that's something that we plan to accomplish by the year 2030. We call it our 30 by 30 pledge.
We're also working with partner countries and organizations to protect and sustain the ocean, including by reducing illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, said Undersecretary Fernandez.
World Ocean Day is an opportunity to come together and galvanize support for conservation in the ocean, for keeping the ocean pristine and to finding ways to stop pollution from the ocean. And the fact of the matter is that we're running out of time in order to clean up our oceans. We have a crisis with the ocean, and we have our work cut out for us.
The United States is committed to protecting our ocean and securing a better future for the planet.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.